This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run a backdoor play if they can get it.
Under 10. Backdoor.
Goes out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
We're here on the eve of Princeton reunions, Thursday of a reunions weekend at the Broadcast Center here at Princeton. I'm joined by Steve Mills, class of 81. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mitch. I'm excited to be here. Excited to be here as part of reunions weekend. Excited to be here as part of your podcast.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun, and we're really pleased that we're getting a chance to visit for a little bit. And, you know, you're a father of a graduating alum. You're, a current general manager of the New York Knicks. You're, a former player at Princeton. But first, before all of that, you know, you're born in Roosevelt, New York, and Hempstead. I talked to Craig Robinson the other day. He mentioned the Hempstead Youth Center and how he did, I think he may have worked a summer there as first experience coaching. Talk about, if you don't mind, a little bit about, your dad, and the court. And I know it's named for your father up there. But talk a little bit about growing up in Hempstead.
Well, my dad and mom were obviously, as most kids, really influential in my life. And growing up, I grew up in Roosevelt. It was really a really sort of tough town. It's not an easy place to grow up. But my dad was a very influential basketball coach in the town. Two towns over from us, Hempstead.
Did he also teach?
Yes, he was a teacher.
What did he teach?
He taught business administration. He also was started the lacrosse program at Hempstead. He was one of the assistant coaches on the football team, and my uncle was the head coach on the football team. So I grew up,
athletics goes deep.
Yeah, it's like, it was really a
and
part
coaching.
Of coaching. Yeah, my dad. I mean, my brother and I joke around all the time that my dad used to sit at the kitchen table and would use every utensil or piece of anything that was on the table, like it's salt and pepper shakers, everything, it's forks. This is what you do. This is how you attack a 2-3 zone. This is what happens when you get double teamed. This is where you're supposed to look for the outlet. And so we just grew up in that kind of environment. I grew up going to basketball practice with my dad all the time on the weekends. I was like a ball boy for the team when I would have a chance to go to games at in the afternoon. I'd carry the balls out on the court. So I just grew up around sports in general. But basketball was obviously the most important thing. But we grew up playing, I grew up playing lacrosse and grew up playing baseball and football. And basketball was the thing I loved the most.
Yeah. And so your uncle, I know that the basketball court's named for your dad and the football field, is that named for your uncle as well?
Yes, it was really.
What an incredible thing.
My dad and my uncle, they were two of the first African-American teachers in Nassau County. And then they gradually worked their way up into coaching. But I went to the ceremony, probably about 7 or 8 years ago when they named the court after for my dad. And that was just seeing all these players that came back and guys that I grew up, idolizing for those guys to come back and be part of the ceremony. But then last year was the first time I actually went to the football field. I went out to Long Island to see my mom, and it was during the spring. And I said, well, let me go out here and see what the football field is like too, because most of the time I would go, it was in the winter, so I'd just go see the basketball court. But it was really, it made me really proud of my family and just the impact that they had in that community. And my father and uncle started a youth center.
Yeah, talk about the Hempstead Youth Center.
Yeah, so. It's actually called the Percy Jackson Youth Center. It was started out as the Hempstead Youth Center, and I remember
who's Percy Jackson?
Percy Jackson, one of my best friends from high school that I played basketball with. His older brother was an exceptional football player and a track athlete in Hempstead. And he unfortunately was in a track meet and died of heart failure when he was going to a community college. He was probably 19 years old. And so at that point, they named the Hempstead Youth Center, renamed it the Percy Jackson Memorial Youth Center.
And what was the center? What was it?
It was, it's one of those places where, when it started, I remember as a really young. My dad and two of my uncles decided they wanted to start this youth center, and they received some funding from the county, and there was an old, like, delicatessen or something that had closed down. And we would go in there, and we cleaned out the basement, and we cleaned out the storefront. It was just a storefront. And they ended up opening it up. It had bumper pool tables and a pool table and some ping pong tables. And it was a place where kids could go to just have some place they could go after school on the weekends. And eventually evolved into the county gave them a new building. And then that would became sort of a hub of activities for our community. There were, you know, kids could go there and do ceramics. It was a place we would go and play pool and bumper.
A little bit of everything for everybody.
There was a boxing ring. So the boxers from our area, that's where they trained.
Sounded like a place for lots to do, but also the people were important.
Right. It was really just a big center of our community. It was a place where you knew you could go there, and it was a safe environment, and you're around kids, you know, competing and having fun. It was mm-hmm. it was a great place.
So tell me a little bit about when you at Friends Academy, you know, kind of what your experience was like there. And when did you start to realize that basketball could be, you know, something that played a big part in your life?
That was going to Friends Academy was probably one of the most pivotal decisions that I can't say I made it because my parents made it on my behalf.
Because, it seems to be a current trend with a lot of us.
Because I was a good basketball player, and there was a school, Long Island Lutheran, that was at that time, they were a top 10 school in the country. And that's where I went to a Lutheran junior high school. I was slated to go to Long Island Lutheran. And I was really excited. That's where I went to camps. That's where I knew the guys that were playing there. There was a big it was a big time school for Long Island, or on the East Coast for that matter. And then my mom and dad were approached by a guy named Albie Swartz, who was a really good point guard for St. John's, and he was hired as a basketball coach at Friends Academy, which was a Quaker school in Long Island, very small school, no basketball history. And he was hired as the coach, and he was going to try to build a program there. And he wanted me to come, and I was his first player recruited. So I went and took the test, and I was able to get into the school, and then received a scholarship. Mm. So that's
now where recruiting in high school is sort of commonplace.
Yes.
But this was new.
This was new. Yes, it was. It was new. So I was the first player he recruited there, and it was. You know, it was tough for me initially because
you started as a freshman there.
Yeah, I started as a freshman. I played. I started all 4 years, but I would still go to games at Long Island Lutheran, and I'd see 1,000 people at their games, and there were 40 people watching us play, and it was really difficult for me to sometimes come to grips with this is what my basketball experience was. But I also took advantage of the fact that this guy was a great point guard. Could teach me a lot about the game, and it taught me a lot about sacrifices and commitment. I mean, to go to that school the first year, the coach would come pick me up at my house and take me to school every day because I lived too far away to get public transportation provided by the town or the county. So he would take me to school every day. So it's not when you're whatever ninth grader to ride to school every day with your coach, go to practice, and ride home with him every day wasn't like the best experience.
Yeah.
And so the following 3 years, I made a different kind of sacrifice. My mom and dad, we all decided that I was going to go live with my grandmother. And my grandmother lived in Hempstead, which was 15 minutes away, but it was close enough where I could have transportation to school. So I ended up for 3 years basically living with my grandmother during the week, and I would come home to Roosevelt during the weekend. So but that was the time where I said, okay, I was still, people would see me as a basketball player. I'd still be in the newspapers for our games, and college coaches were still recruiting me. So I felt like I really didn't give up everything by going to Friends instead of Long Island Lutheran, but it actually set me up to come to a place like Princeton. Mm-hmm. Because when I was getting recruited by, Iona.
I was going to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
What were some of the – so, one of the themes I've always knowing you is you mentioned commitment and sacrifice. This is a big part of who you are now, and not much has changed. But also in your recruiting process, Walk me through that, if you don't mind. Like, how did you sort of guide yourself, and how did you get to a place like Princeton, and who else was recruiting you?
I was getting recruited by a lot of different kinds of schools, like everything from the University of Hawaii to University of Detroit to the Lafayette's Lehighs of the world. And I think the closest non-Ivy that I really contemplated going to was Iona. And at that point, Iona had a pretty successful program. They were building something really good there. Jim Valvano was the coach, and so he was a highly recognized guy. And
did he recruit you?
Yeah, so? No. When I, you know, you
what
come,
was he like?
He was a salesman. Yeah. He'd, you know, I would come home from school, and there'd be days where he would be at my house already, sitting in the kitchen. We had this little kitchen, and you know, I was joking around with my friends, like all the coaches used to wear these like patent leather shoes and these shiny shoes. And I went back to school one day. I said, yeah, Jim Valvano was at the house yesterday. And they said, did he have on the shiny shoes? And I said, yeah, he did. So he was really coming to sell, I guess, that day. So he used to, you know, he would come there and would tell me about all of the people that were being recruited. Actually, Jeff Rulin, who ended up having probably a 12-year NBA career. Jeff and I were both players in Long Island that the same year.
He ended up being the coach there for a while.
And he ended up coaching there. So Jeff and I visited together. We actually took a recruiting visit together. So
was this before or after your Princeton visit?
This was early. I was being recruited by Princeton.
And who recruited you from Princeton?
Coach Carrill. Okay. Bob Duquette came to see me a lot, but Coach Carrill would come see me play.
And what was that? So like when you started to say to people like, okay, I'm looking at Iona, Detroit, Princeton, how did that, when you know you go to a school like Friends Academy, how did that go?
My guidance counselor thought I was crazy. So I would just play along with it. So one day I told her, I said, I think I'm going to the University of Hawaii. I decided. I mean, I had received a likely letter from Princeton and likely to get admitted, which in a competitive school like Friends, I don't know, I may have been only, there may be a two kids in the school that got likely letters, and I was one of them. And I was telling her, I think I'm going to go to the University of Hawaii. So she thought I was out of my mind, but I was just joking around with her. But the thing that happened was that Iona wanted me to commit to them. The timing is so different now, but they wanted me to commit before the season. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to commit in September. And I just wasn't sure. I wasn't ready. I didn't know whether I could get a better opportunity if I had a really good senior year. And then as I went through the process, I really said, you know, I think that if I go to an Ivy League school and if I'm good enough to play in the NBA, NBA scouts will see me. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not, I'll get a great education. So that's when I narrowed it down to Columbia and Princeton.
I imagine you're fast. You're a very good shooter, very good player. I would imagine Coach Carrill didn't show up in his shiny loafers.
No.
What was that? What were his words to you? I mean, we all have, I think, you know, stories of coaches, you know, ability to be very honest with us.
I think the best way to sum up how Coach treated me in this process was that probably about a year ago, my mom found a letter. She was going through some mail, and it was a letter that Coach Carrill sent me. And so I'm getting recruited by the guys in the shiny shoes, and all, you know, these coaches are coming to see me, and they're at the house, and they're at my games. And Coach Carrill sends me this long letter that says
handwritten,
and it basically says that, you know, there's some things that you do well, that there's some things I like about you. There are a lot of weaknesses, and you have to get stronger, and you have to get faster, and you have to get tougher. But if you do all these things and you come to Princeton, I think you can be a decent player. Mm. And I came. So
how does that work again? Why does that work on all of us?
It's amazing. I think when I came down here to visit and walked into Jadwin and met with him. You know, he showed me all this videotape of Brian Taylor, like we were going to be running up and down, and I was going to play like Brian Taylor. I think he was just a little better than me, so maybe we would have played that way if I was good enough. But, you know, the history of this place, and you know you're going to expect to win Ivy League championships. That's a given. You know that you're going to play against nationally ranked teams all the time and get a chance to play against – great teams. But it was a big sacrifice because also I was the last class that had to play freshman. So in addition to all these other decisions, points, or things that were helping influence my decision, one of the real negatives was that I thought I was good enough to play right
away.
Was
that an Ivy League rule?
It was the Ivy League rule.
And who was the freshman coach?
Tony Relvis.
Okay. And did Coach come to the freshman game?
Yes. Yes. I'll never forget. Actually, Bob Duquette coached our freshman team. Tony was the assistant for Coach Creel. I will never forget that we had a freshman game against Navy. And I missed a shot at the end of the game. And Coach Creel, the varsity, was playing after us. Coach Creel came into the locker room and told me I had embarrassed the entire university, my family, and all my friends, that I should never miss a shot like that again. So he was definitely paying attention to
us. Yeah, I would say so. My goodness. So then you start the following years, you're at Princeton, you're sociology major, you're sort of guiding yourself through the path. Walk me through the next couple of years and then into graduation.
It was a great experience. Because we had the freshman rule, we were recruited with a bigger class than I think most guys get recruited now. So we had 7 or 8 guys that were recruited to play. So we had a good group of friends that were basketball guys that we sort of connected with. And then as we moved up to play in the varsity, there were maybe 3 or 4 of us that made the varsity team the next year, maybe 3. But we were all like there was a support group that one of us was – I was starting right from the beginning, but the other guys would really support me. And when I wasn't playing as much, I would support them. So it made playing a lot easier. But it was still a tough transition. I mean, my mom tells me, all the time, I don't remember this, but she would tell me that I would call home really struggling and questioning whether or not I was smart enough to be here and how hard the work was and how difficult things were. So, but, to fight through that, but it was still a great experience. The guys that I played with, almost all those guys I'm still really close to.
Randy Melville, Dave Blatt, right? Who were some of the other guys in your class?
Marty Mannion was in my class, a guy named Tom Turkla, who was a guy who was a football player and a basketball player but just tore his knees up a couple of times. I just had dinner with him recently. Craig Robinson, who wasn't in my class, but Craig used to come and spend the summer with me in Long Island. We work at the Percy Jackson Youth Center. So it was a really good group of guys. And even the younger guys, Billy Ryan, Rich Simpkiss, those guys, we just had a good bond. And it's something that really was helpful to me getting through the university, enjoying my time here and having some success and having fun.
Yeah. What a small world for, several years later for you and Dave to cross paths with the Knicks and the Cavs, the last couple of years. Obviously he's not with the Cavs now, but that must have been really, an out-of-body moment for you.
It was really exciting. I mean, Dave and I stayed close. We were recruited to play in the backcourt together. We met when we were 17. He was in my wedding. And so we stayed close through the years, and it's funny, when I initially got out of school, I went and played in South America for a year. I had a job as a banker, but they said they would put off the job until I got back. And Dave was working, and so Dave called me one day and said he was thinking about – he didn't want to work at Xerox anymore. He wanted to go play, so he went to Israel. But through that process, he and I always stayed close through the years and would always follow each other, what was going on from a basketball perspective. But it was really – I was really so proud to see him get that job in the Cavs, with the Cavs.
Yeah, we all were.
Yeah, and then, we had an opportunity to go play. I think it was our second game of the season, I believe, his first home game. And I think we beat them in Cleveland. So that was kind of fun too.
You're smiling right now. One of my favorite things that we do with Princeton basketball is we give out some postseason awards. We don't have many. One of them is the Paul Friedman Award, which has been, in many ways, the award that sort of, this is really coming down from Coach Carroll, that embodies everything that we stand for. It's the gist of it is the person who gives their very best in every way And, you know, we don't always give the award out, but you knew Paul, if you could just talk about him.
Yeah, Paul was a special guy.
And maybe talk about, you know, what happened.
Yeah, he was, he was a guy that Paul, I knew for a long time because he was another Long Island guy. So we played, we went to camp at Long Island Lutheran together. We never played against each other actually, but, you know, just in the circle of Long Island basketball, we always encountered each other. So it was great for him to come to Princeton, for us to come together, and he was just a special guy who, you know, again, was part of that bigger class, but he was one of the guys that was, you know, found his way to get onto the varsity, and then, you know, all of a sudden started having some different pains in his hip and his leg, and eventually it just kept getting worse, and it turned out he had a form of cancer. And, you know, passed away. So it was just it's really tough at that age. It's hard to even comprehend what it's like when you're that age to lose someone that you're playing basketball with or that you're friends with, because when you're that young, you feel invincible and don't think about things like that. But he was a guy that worked hard all the time, you know, was limited in terms of, you know, some of his physical skills, but he played hard and he could see a lot of things, was a great passer, you know, kind of things that Coach Carrillo likes.
Well, that's what I was going to say, which is why, I mean, I think it's an important award for Coach and for all of us, is that Paul got everything out of himself, which is the quality I think that was valued a lot. You know, if you were talented but didn't get everything out of yourself, that was like, you know, you were going to get it every day, right? So after graduation, you know, you played a little bit, started a job, and then you sort of get into the NBA. If you wouldn't mind, walk me through. You know, you had a long time in the NBA, but you really got to the NBA in 84?
Right.
When I was young then. That's when I started watching the NBA. This was, you know, the games, there was one game a week, maybe two games a week, but, you know, it was Lakers and Celtics. There was a lot of talent in the league. Tell me about you were 24, 25 years old starting with the league. So, you know, there's a lot that's changed, but maybe tell me about the mid-80s NBA.
It was a special time to be part of the NBA. David Stern had just become commissioner.
What year did he start? You know?
I think he started in – David Stern became commissioner in 1984.
84. And do you remember who the commissioner was before?
It was Larry O'Brien. Mm-hmm. So David was working for the league. He had initially worked at Proskauer, which was one of the law firms that – supported the NBA or worked with the NBA. Then he came on to be the inside lawyer, and then he ran the business, NBA properties, a lot of the business aspects of the NBA. And then when Larry O'Brien retired, David became commissioner. Maybe that happened in January or February was the official handoff. I started in March.
So you came in with David?
Yes, I came. He interviewed me. I interviewed with about three or four people. And I really remember this. The last set of interviews, I went into David's office. We were sitting, and he looked at my resume and he said, "Well, you know, I think one of the things that I really like about you is that, you know, you were a banker after you played in South America. You were a banker, which means, you know, there was some attention to detail, precision about how you view things." But then also you're a basketball player who chose to go to Princeton to play basketball. And that says something about your thought process, your intellect, your commitment to, you know, wanting to do things a certain way. And that's why I'm giving you this job.
What a moment, right? Like a path just getting started for you right there. One guy recognizing, you know, these are the things that you and I talk about a lot, you know, outside of this room is this is what you're choosing.
What was amazing to me, it was the first time I realized how important Princeton on your resume was. I didn't really understand it.
We can tell somebody who's 17 until we're blue in the face, right?
Yeah. Like,
it's hard to pass up those shiny loafers sometimes, you know? But it's because of that stuff. And so, you know, he's pretty credited for so many different things. But talk about him for a second. What were his first few years like, and did you get a chance to watch the development of and the way he guided the NBA in that time?
He was an incredibly detailed guy, paid attention to everything. Every detail was important. And he had a vision for what he wanted the league to be.
What was his vision?
He felt like we were a league that was – the league was too black because the vast majority of our players were black at the time, still are. But that was – that there were a lot of drug scandals with NBA players at that point in time. And the guys made a lot of money. So he looked at the league and said, okay, the public – looks at the NBA and says, okay, the players are too black, they make too much money, and they all use drugs.
Did you see the 30 for 30 documentary on the Knicks that was last week? So this was not 10 years earlier. You've got a really good Knicks team where they, it took them to win an NBA championship for those guys to start making some money. So we weren't that far away from an era when guys didn't get paid.
Right.
So this made sense that there would be an influx of money coming in.
Right, right. And his approach to the league was that I can't do anything about the makeup of the guys or the color of the skins the guys of, that are playing in the league. So I will promote the fact that they are the best athletes in the world. And every night you're going to see that. Then I'll deal with the drug issue by creating a drug program. So it's the first sports league to have a drug program that says if you use drugs at certain levels, you're going to get kicked out of the league. And then we'll come up with a salary cap that says you can not like how much players make, but you should understand that what they make is a function of the business.
Did you get a chance to see him talk and work with owners?
Yes, I was.
That must have been amazing for you being in your 20s to see him navigate. How old was he at the time?
He was probably in his 40s, I guess. He was. What was amazing about David is that he felt like, no matter who you were, he could do your job better than you. And I watched him tell network executives that they didn't know anything about how they were covering NBA basketball. And this is what the announcers should be focusing on. And
was
this
he right?
He usually was right. he would – I was fortunate. There was a period of time when I was managing all these events all around the world. And, he called me one day and said, Steve, the music's too loud in the arena. You're not paying enough attention to how quickly the pace of the slam dunk contest. And it got to the point where he would get so upset about what was going on that we implemented this phone. So I would sit at courtside.
A red phone.
It was a red phone.
It was.
He'd have it at his seat. And I'd have it at my seat at the courtside so that when he was upset about something, he could talk to me about it right then because it would be too much.
My current players would think this is hilarious.
It'd be too much
you
if it was.
You can't text somebody and say.
Oh, it was. Yeah,
red phone is a red lot phone. More powerful.
It was, it was powerful. My wife used to sit across the arena and just wait to see how many times I was going to lift up the phone because she knew it wasn't good if it would happen too often. But
the slam dunk contest, the All-Star game back then, everybody sat down and watched that.
Right.
This was Jordan. This was 87 Jordan. This was
– the funny thing, if you watch closely at the first slam dunk contest where Spud Webb wins.
Spud Webb Dominique.
Spud Webb Dominique. And in
– 86, 87?
It's not the – it was the one in Dallas.
Well, it was one when Spud won.
Yes.
Which everybody's – it was the most incredible thing. And you remember like – even Dominique was high-fiving everybody,
right.
And he was the guy.
But it was the beauty of the NBA. At that point, we probably had 60 people working for the NBA. If you watch the videotape of that dunk contest, I was the guy that was collecting the scores from the judges as they, were filling out their scorecards. And then I was the one that went over to the sideline when Spud won to take him out to center court to get his award. But that's what we did. There were 60 of us. We might work on transportation. You might be dressed up like a ball boy to help guys get
– how many people in the NBA now?
Now they're probably about 1,100 or 1,200. There was one point when I left the NBA in 99, there was one point we were up to 1,300 people. Hmm. So
– did you get a chance to go to some of those Celtics-Lakers finals and be a part of that?
I did. I went to one of the last games in the Boston Garden that was, a Celtics – one of the last finals games they had there. So I had a chance to – I would get a chance to go to a lot of those games, especially the ones in
Brilliant.
In the Lakers.
You were in the NBA, and it's hard for me not to talk about this because it's – you know, we have never really discussed this, you and I, but that was the NBA I grew up with. It was Celtics-Lakers, and then it became, you know, Celtics-Pistons, Pistons-Bulls. And it was – you saw the maturation of so many different players, but also the league was changing so much, including the rules.
Right.
And then as you get into the 90s – you know, were you there for that? Like how the league started to change,
yes.
And how it, what was the impact?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The whole progression was personally interesting for me because I grew up with around the corner from Julius Erving, so I've known Julius since I was a kid. You know, Magic and Bird and Isaiah and all those guys were guys that either I played against or we were the same age. So I'm working in the NBA.
Go ahead, start over.
Okay, so I'm working in the NBA, and those guys are sort of moving into their prime, and the league is changing from it's moving from you know the Julius Erving sort of era to now it's Magic, Bird, and I'm watching these guys that I feel like I'm peers with age wise all of a sudden take over this league, and then you watch. You know, Michael come into the league, and I remember the first time I met Michael, he was coming to get an award, and we needed to make sure he got there because it was his rookie year, and he won like 3 awards. And so we wanted to make sure Bird got there and that Michael got there, and I was responsible for dealing with Michael. So we chartered him. He was going back to school to finish a course. And so we chartered a plane from North Carolina to come to Utah, I think, was where we were. But it was the first time he'd ever been on a charter. So I go to meet him at the airport, go out to the runway, and he's like talking to me about this plane. And so we take him to get his award. And as soon as it's over, he says, we have to take him back because he has to get back to North Carolina. And the whole time we're going back to the airport, he says, Steve, you gotta see this plane. I mean, they have this food on there. So he asked me to come on the plane and just sit there and watch the kind of food that they had. So that's how I got a chance to meet him.
His but that life just, was
but it's so funny to, you know, it was an interesting time to see mm-hmm. all of a sudden the league change. And a lot of it was David wanting to make these guys stars, willingness right. to make them stars.
And Michael, you know, Magic and Larry were there, but Michael was really his first one.
Right.
And an easy person to sort of grab onto, right?
And it's a decision you have to make that can be sort of difficult because once you – I mean, you know, when you look at the NFL – and the NFL is so much built around the brands of the teams and the brands of the league. And, you know, the NFL, in my opinion, can lose any player at any point in time and it not impact the mm-hmm. game at all. So now all of a sudden to build your business around these guys and, you know, they're fragile human beings that can make mistakes, but you're building your business around their personalities and their athleticism. So there was risk there, but I think it ultimately paid off well mm-hmm. for the NBA.
Yeah, it's funny you know, because we all know, like, you look at a team like Oklahoma City right now. Here we are in the finals. Oklahoma City is up 3-2 on the Warriors. You've got, you know, some of the best teams in the NBA right now, record-wise, are real teams. And yet it is still a star league, and here you have Durant and Westbrook really kind of putting their stamp on some things. But – you know, going back to those Bulls teams, you've got what you're talking about is very interesting to me because it's about, you know, here's a branding of certain guys, but it's still to win. You've got to trust. And that was really like when Michael, I mean, I'm from the Midwest. So when he decided to start involving his teammates, that's how he was going to be able to beat the Pistons.
Right.
And you know, you see the same thing with Kobe, and now I think you're seeing it with Durant and Westbrook too. You're seeing this change, and the right. Warriors really are a collection of very good teammates.
I mean, that's what you know. I think that what's fun for me about working with Phil is that while we played a different kind of basketball here at Princeton than the Triangle, I mean, we had an offense that was different than their offense, but the things that were important to a team were similar, you know, the attention to detail, precision, understanding spacing, timing, effort on cuts, playing defense, even though people think of you, all they do is want to talk about your offense, where we all know it all starts at the defensive end, how we're going to defend.
Which is a big part of that, Phil, that those Knicks teams when Holtzman got there, that was it. We're going to defend.
Right.
And that's a big part of, you know, even his Bulls teams and the Lakers teams, those teams really worked at it.
Right. So you know, when you look at some of the Bulls teams that had success and you look at the Lakers teams that had success, well, they all had great players and stars. There always was a style of play. And even when they didn't have the complete set of players, there was a way that they played as a team and moved and how they functioned that resonates with anyone that plays at Princeton. And so that's what we look forward to, is as we sort of evolve as a team, in terms of having a style of play that you can see how it works and how it functions, yeah, independent of any one particular player.
You mentioned Phil Jackson, which, you know, I want to talk more about that. But let's go back just to your transition from working for the league and then to then working at,
sure,
you know, you join MSG, you're working for both the Knicks and the Rangers, even the Liberty a little bit, and then you sort of transition into the current role, GM, general manager. What was that transition like for you?
Well, the transition from the league office to the team had to do with my sort of competitive thing that's in me as a basketball player, and that at the league office, it's sort of a zero-sum game. Every night a team wins and every night a team loses, and you're not really tied to the wins and losses, but that's counter to who I am. I want to be involved in building a team, and so my involvement in like the Olympic teams and things like that were, at least we felt like we were going to win a gold medal, but it was the process of building a team and being part of the wins and losses. So I wanted to go to work for a team. It happened to be that the Knicks offered me an opportunity. And so as a kid who grew up in sort of a tough part of Long Island, and I really had been to one Knicks game my entire life when I was a junior in high school, someone took me to a Knicks game. So my family couldn't afford to go to games. So it was, you know, an opportunity for me to go in and sort of run the business operations and be involved with the basketball operations, you know, with the Knicks was a special opportunity that I felt like I couldn't pass up.
Yeah. And just since this is a basketball podcast, at some point, the next one, we'll talk about the Rangers a little bit, because I know you got a lot of hockey stories as well. But so, you know, just jumping forward, you know, because of the last couple of years, but you know, the draft has been a really big part for franchises in terms of the improvement. You know, and as much as you're able to talk about it, you know, because we all now know see Porzingis's year, right?
Right.
Like, and sort of where, but like the work that goes into like identifying him initially, and then kind of, okay, we have the fourth pick. You got a lot of guys that you could choose from. But maybe as much as you're able, talk us through, you know, give us an idea of what that process looked like.
Yes, we felt like the draft was going to be important. It was one of the things when I came back to the Knicks, one of the commitments I made to the owner and to myself was that we weren't going to trade our draft pick away. We had traded all of the picks up until even this year. We don't have a pick because it was traded in the Borgnani trade. But we made a commitment that we weren't going to pick trade our picks. So it put us in a situation where, you know, we had the fourth pick in the draft. We knew that we could get a good player. And you know, when you're that high, we knew the lowest we could be, I believe, was five, if I remember correctly. You know, there's a universe of maybe 15 guys that you're really locked in on. But
it's really small.
But so you do.
Did you have most of those guys through?
We had most of them through. We had spent a lot of time with them. We would bring them in for multiple visits. But Kristaps was a guy that stood out right from the beginning.
What was it about him?
Just his versatility, his you know, the things that he could do for someone his size, his ability to shoot, his rebounding ability, even though it didn't necessarily demonstrate it in Europe, but you could see that he had an opportunity to be a good rebounder. He had a really good feel offensively for the game. We thought he could – He would be pretty quickly a good help side defender. So the downside of him was just physical.
Mm-hmm.
That how long was it going to take for him to physically be able to withstand?
He's still 19.
He's 20.
Did you have a sense of his personality?
Yes. That's
seems to be a defining factor in his development, his ability to handle New York.
Yes. We
it's been fun to follow him this year.
We had one of our scouts, Clarence Gaines, had gone over to see him and sent Phil and I a note, a text that said, it doesn't matter where we are in the draft, whether even if we get the first pick, we have to think about this kid. And so maybe a month later, as we started to – still didn't know what our position would be, but I went over and watched him, and I came away with the same thing. As long as we were willing to wait, if he physically wasn't able to really compete at a really high level the first year or second year here, we all knew that he had, you know, an incredible upside and an incredible amount of talent. But then when we had a chance to meet him – we were convinced that this kid had the mental makeup to withstand the pressure of even if the success wasn't there initially, that he had enough sort of inner strength and inner confidence to be able to deal with that. And that's what pushed us over the top in deciding that we would pick him. And Phil and I would talk all the time. We'd listen to all the scouts and then we'd talk about what we would think, what we would do, what we were thinking about. And I think, you know, I don't know what level, but we would have, even if we were much higher, we would have selected this guy.
It's funny, little things stand out, but Lopez had a birthday during the season, and there's a video that was on MSG Network, I caught it, of Kristaps singing him happy birthday, which is what rookies have to do. It was probably a little bit of part of the initiation, but he really was going for it. Happy birthday, right? And that's part of it, right? Like, it's like, don't think too – you're a rookie. He was willing – here's this kid that's the toast of New York in a lot of ways, but willing to put himself out there for the team.
Yeah. He is a competitor, and one of the things that we use to describe him when we think about his personality, he's a guy that doesn't want to be famous. He wants to be great. That's what comes – when you spend time with him, that's what sticks out, and he does it in a – quiet way. He's always focused on, you know, watching videos, trying to understand how he has to do things to get better. But he has I saw it when we played New Orleans the first time at the Garden, and Anthony Davis had a great game that game. But you could see it. Kristaps didn't say anything before the game, but you could see it once the ball tipped that he had this thing. This guy is supposed to be the best young big in the game right now, and I'm going at him tonight. Mm-hmm. And that was his mentality from the minute the clock started.
Yeah, little junkyard dog in there, right?
Yeah, you have to be around him to know that that's in there, but mm-hmm. it's deep in his sort of makeup.
Yeah. Your background is so interesting. A lot of signs point that, you know, maybe coaching could have been a career too. And, you know, you're obviously doing great, and you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing, but – Coach Carroll sometimes teases me. He says, you know, whenever you start talking to your plate at dinner, sort of you talking about your dad, then you know you're in a lot of trouble about coaching the team. And it's hard to sort of separate yourself sometimes from the teaching and the coaching. But do you, you know, in your role, you're very involved with the team. Do you find how do you separate from the minutia and see the big picture? Because, you know, this is a development process.
It's, you know, you have to do both. And I think, you know, from a coaching standpoint, that's what I love about working with Phil, because he can, you know, I can learn things about how to look at a team and building a team from a coach's perspective.
You know, talk about that a little bit more.
You know, sometimes we would go through times and there were some roster decisions we made this year that Phil was really against. And in some cases, Derek Fisher and I went to him and said, listen, we really think we need this guy. We're looking for a scoring punch. We're looking for this. And in some of the instances, he said, okay, I'll go with it. But his hesitancy was always that I worry the decisions that the coach is going to have to make in terms of trying to find minutes for all these guys. So he, you know, sometimes as a general manager, you try to figure out a way to provide the coach with the talent that he needs and that he's asking for, but you don't always think about how it's going to fit from a minute management standpoint and those kinds of things that are important to the composition, you know, the mental composition of a team and how people react to limited playing time. So those kinds of things. And I think the coaching part of it is interesting because I tell people all the time, any of us that played for Coach Carrill feel like we could be a coach because that's what he taught us, to really understand, you know, all of the technical aspects of the game and how to read situations. So, I didn't think Dave was going to be a coach as we played together. I didn't think Craig was going to be a coach as we played together. But I think, you know, you're taught the game at such a level of detail.
He strips you bare, too, early on, right? Like there's an exposure of what all your weaknesses are. It starts in the recruiting process.
Right, right.
A lot of us coaching. That's just a testament to him.
It really is. Really is.
Recently, you guys hired Jeff Hornacek. And, and when you welcome a new coach into the team, like, you know, what was your impressions of him? And if you can talk about it, like his impressions, if you can talk about Jeff for a second, of Phil Jackson and the Knicks and you. And
I think we went through a process of interviewing, a lot of people for this job, and we knew the kinds of guys that we thought would be successful with our team, and we made sure we limited the conversations to guys that we thought could be successful. And really, it was at the end of the day, it had to be someone that could understand how to play system basketball. And Jeff is interesting in the sense that he comes from a
His
great pedigree.
Sort of screams of it.
Yeah, and of coaches. He actually a background of playing for great coaches. He was always thought of as a guy who got the most out of his, mm-hmm. His physical gifts. We joked around at one of our dinners that he thought about going. He wasn't a highly recruited player at all, and he received a likely letter from Cornell, and he and his family couldn't sort of comprehend this whole, okay, you're likely to get in, but what does that really mean? And it's a financial aid school, so what does that mean? And the scholarship to Iowa was much cleaner and easy to understand. But we talked about the whole Ivy League basketball experience when we went through the interview process.
Yeah. Well, still conversations we're still having. Those, but once you get it, it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
You're here this weekend on what is reunions weekend, but also quickly spills into graduation. Your daughter Danielle is graduating. I think this has gone by very quickly. What's this weekend like for you?
Oh, it's really, really just amazing. I'm still trying to grasp everything. But it's, the idea of the university is so important to me and my development. And when my daughter decided to come here, it was just really, really exciting. And I was happy for her because I knew it would be a great place for her. And to watch, the friendships that she's made and how she's grown as a student and a person through this period, this is a really incredible time for us. The 4 years have gone by so quickly, and it's a different. I'm used to seeing the 4 years go by quickly because I'm so connected, and I'm proud, and I love being connected to the basketball program. So I get to get to know guys when they come in as a freshman.
Yeah,
and I'm always amazed when next thing I know they're graduating or they're a senior.
It's a different place for you too, right? Because you're Steve Mills to a lot of us, but you're now Danielle's dad to a lot of other people.
That hit me last night. We went to the PVC, the Princeton Varsity Club Awards banquet last night, and there's a young man, a wrestler, who received an award, and I was really proud of his story. And he's from Long Island, so I went up to him and introduced myself to him and told him I played basketball here and that I was from Roosevelt. And he said, "Okay, really nice to meet you." And he turned and started. Finished off his conversation. Then he turned back to me and said, "Are you Danielle's dad?" And so I said, "Yeah." So there were probably four instances last night where I was connected as dad. I was recognized as Danielle's dad instead of Steve, the guy who played basketball here at Princeton.
Well, I think this is an exciting weekend for you and Beverly, and hope you guys have a great time on Tuesday and wish the best for Danielle. I don't want to let you get out of here without talking about Coach Carrill really quickly. And could you share I told Craig Robinson this too. This is a family podcast, but can you share a coach story that comes to mind?
There are not many that I can share on a family podcast, but it was my first recruiting visit when I came here, and he took me out on the court, and it's just the two of us. And he said that, you know, when you play basketball in this rectangle is where sort of your character gets revealed. All of your weaknesses, what you're good at, what you're not good at. And most people can live their life just ignoring their weaknesses. You can just move along and everything will be fine, be okay. But in basketball, you're going to have an opportunity to face your weaknesses and make a decision to either accept them and just sort of move along or to try to recognize them and change. And it's going to be clear for all your teammates to see everything you do on the court. It's going to reveal your character. And, you know, I was 17 and the guy has me out on the court talking about these things, but it's something that has an influence. I remember it like it was yesterday. It has an influence on everything that I do, at my approach to everything from, you know, when I was working on business related things to being a general manager and just all those basketball lessons and basketball memories and to about character and decisions and hard work that you know, he's a guy that had such a profound impact on my life. I can't thank him enough.
Well, it's while you're going through it, it can be hell and, you know, phone calls home. Right. And but I think a lot of people feel similarly. And I always felt like and feel because I have a lot of friends that are back here from sort of my era that I played with and won a lot of games with. And Phil, there's a real sense of closeness with those guys because he went through something and you're on a team while you were a student here.
Right. I will say, and then there's one other instance where I went through a period of where he pulled me out of the starting lineup and he was really upset with my effort and upset with a couple of things. And he said to me that Steve, he pulled me aside as the bus, we were getting ready to go on the bus. He said, "Steve, I don't know why I'm even taking you on this trip because you're not going to play this weekend." And I didn't really like that. And then he said, "But, you know, tell me what you're thinking right now." And again, I was 17 or 18, and I don't know what to say to him. I'm just looking at him. He said, "No, you should tell me what you're thinking, because after you finish, I'm going to tell you exactly how I feel about you." And so that kind of brutal honesty, you know, is something that he forced us to deal with all the time.
Mm-hmm. Last night at the PVC banquet, John Thompson said to the crowd, "You'll never have a boss that's as honest with you as your coach." And we had a real honest one. He didn't hold back. I think that from my perspective, getting to know you in the last few years, you know, having a common bond with Coach has been a real connector. But also, you know, all of the current players know you, and it's a real pleasure, Steve, to be able to see you so often and to know that, you know, while you're up there with the Knicks, you're very busy and you're doing some really important stuff. You're also bleed the orange and black, and we really appreciate you being here this weekend.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.